It is Monday, August the 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, parts of Iraqi city liberated from Islamic State. Catastrophic flooding in the U.S. city of Houston.
I'm a third-generation Houstonian. I am watching my beloved city. This will not be months. This will be years.
It's a disaster.
I mean, we were lucky, but I think when we go back, everything we own is gone.
North Korea tensions, prisoners of conscience, plus a 50s-60s superstar. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The Iraqi military says it has fully liberated Talifar's town center from the Islamic State. A week ago, U.S.-backed Iraqi troops launched a multi-pronged operation to retake the city, a month after declaring Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, fully liberated. VOA's Victor Beatty asked former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute, how important the liberation of parts of Talifar is for the Iraqis.
This is important from several standpoints. First of all, the rapidity and the very low casualties of this victory indicates that in the two other areas of Iraq where ISIS still is holding out, in Hawija between Mosul and Baghdad, close to the Euphrates, in Al-Qaim, right on the Jordanian border, that this model of Iraqi army forces, including heavy armor, I saw a lot of U.S. Abrams tanks involved. I mean, they were Iraqi crews, U.S. firepower and air power in particular, is going to very quickly defeat ISIS and drive them from the cities of Iraq, which is a major development. The other issue, though, is that you had the Hashid al-Shaabi, that is these Shia militias, including some that are very close to Iran, involved at least in the periphery of the fight around Talifah. That's not an accident. While Talifah had a significant Shia Turkoman population before the ISIS people drove them out, the main reason that those militias are up there is part of Tehran's plan to lock in routes, and we've seen this warning as a major Iranian strategic goal to undercut essentially the American regional security system. So this is going to be the next big issue that the United States will have to face, both in Iraq and in Syria.
So Iran's footprint is increasing in Iraq?
Absolutely. Certainly in these strategic areas, Iran, through its local supporters, and that's how Iran operates in Lebanon and Yemen and Syria, are clearly trying to compete with the government, the official forces, both claiming that they've defeated ISIS, but more importantly, advancing the Iranian agenda. They're loyal to Tehran more than they are to Baghdad.
With Talifar's imminent fall, what's left of Islamic State territory in Iraq?
As I said, two small cities, Hawija, close to Kirkuk, and Al-Qaim, right on the close to the Jordanian border. And these are areas that are very hard to possess power out of. So I suspect they'll fall quickly.
What is the key to the strategy of winning against Islamic State, and is it working well?
Well, the key was, first of all, a major international effort, a uprising of people who were ideologically opposed to Sunni Islamic extremism. Those are the Kurds, Sunnis, but very opposed to that. And, of course, the Shia Arabs in the south. So, therefore, you had a population that could never really become part of that movement, but rather the movement saw as its enemies, so it was a friend-enemy kind of thing. And that's the language the Middle East, for better or worse, understands. So those enemies of ISIS make up, between the Kurds and the Shia, 80% of the population of Iraq. So with international help, they eventually were able to take back almost all of the country.
The U.S. has indicated it wants to use the same strategy that it apparently is winning against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria against militants in Afghanistan. Is that possible?
Not to the same degree. You do not have anything like the sophisticated Iraqi military forces, where the counterterrorism service is particularly good, although the Afghans have some high-end forces that are good that we're going to develop. So that might be part of the transition of strategy. But the other thing is, you had a popular uprising of both the Shia and the Peshmerga. These are both mass forces that are extremely loyal to their political leadership and will die for them. You don't have anything like that with the Afghan National Army.
Is Islamic State still a potent force?
It's potentially a potent force, as we just saw in Spain, as we've seen with a series of knife attacks just yesterday. in several countries. I think that its ability to inspire terrorist acts in North America and Western Europe and in places like Turkey, possibly Russia, should not be underestimated. But as a state, as a military force, as a major player in the Middle East, as a caliphate, as it likes to call itself, it's in its death phase.
Can the Iraqi government extend its authority across the country with these defeats by of IS?
First of all, only with the cooperation of the Kurds in the north, and that will be done through the Kurds. And in the Sunni areas, it will be delicate, as it was after the defeat of al-Qaeda in 2007-2008. It was never complete, and of course, mistakes made by the Iraqi security forces contributed to many people in the region, the Sunni Arabs of western Iraq turning to ISIS in 2014.
That's James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Tropical Storm Harvey has caused devastating flooding in the fourth largest U.S. city, Houston, Texas. Before the storm made landfall late Friday as a Category 4 hurricane that was to the southwest of Houston, there were forecasts that heavy amounts of rain might fall all along the Texas coast, that is, including Houston. My colleague Lori London caught up with several residents of the Houston area to find out how things are. Dana Steele, who remembers the devastation of Hurricane Ike 9 years ago, is still in her home, and she says she is safe.
But I'm a third-generation Houstonian. Mm. I am watching my beloved city. Mm. This will not be months. This will be years.
It's a disaster.
And it's been 9 years since Ike, and there are some places that are still never reopened or still never recovered or were still never cleaned up. And now this is happening to the entire city. This will take years for this wonderful city to recover.
What is your vantage point, though, from where you are right now, where your home is in Seabrook?
We have a pretty big piece of property, like 3/4 acre, and it's all the way to the upstairs patio.
The water, so it's just,
you can't see that. There's no yard, it's just one giant, for a while there, it looked like we had an infinity pool, but it's over the pool. It's probably 3 or 4 feet over the pool. The downstairs, like I said, has about 2.5 feet of water in it right now. You know, everybody's hoping it's going to drain somewhere, but it's not really. It doesn't have anywhere to drain, and it just keeps coming. And we're expecting, they're saying 15 to 25 inches for the next 24 hours.
So there's no way you could possibly leave your home right now, is there?
No, we can't. We can't evacuate. There's nowhere to go.
Dana Steele lives in that community of Seabrook, which is a Houston suburb. It's to the south of the city. Sharon and Bob Miller live in an area known as Jersey Village. It's on the west side of Houston. Sharon says she awoke Sunday and checked on some feral cats living in her backyard. She said at the time there was no rain, then the skies let loose.
And then within an hour of doing that, there was water in our house. I mean, it happened so fast. I mean, I went outside and fed the cats, and they were fine. And then water came in, and it was started in the, we have a converted garage. It's not a garage anymore. It's living space. And it started in there and then just grew from there. And by the time we left about, 2 o'clock. By the time we got out of there with several cats, it was about knee deep for me. That's probably about a foot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was getting close to my knees. And luckily, our our neighbors have a boat.
Yeah. So our next door neighbors that are renters actually had a boat in their driveway, and they were boating people out as far as they could boat.
Wow.
And then we hoofed it the rest of the way. And we did that with four cat carriers. And got to a friend of ours that lives in Jersey Village, had driven down and got as close as he could get. And we walked in between where the boat could get to where the car could get, and carried all those carriers, and were able to get out. So, I mean, we were lucky, but I think when we go back, everything we own is gone.
I mean, there was at least a foot of water in the house. And from the time it breached our, where the bottom of the wall hits the floor, to the time it was knee-deep was only a matter of an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Were you expecting this to be like this? Or did you think that you guys were in an area that wouldn't be impacted like this?
The quickness that it happened, no. We were not expecting that at all.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Some have described Tropical Storm Harvey as beyond anything ever experienced along the Texas coast. We asked Patrick Burke, lead forecaster at the Weather Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland, what that means.
Right. Well, what that means is that this hurricane has taken a very unique track. It's not something that we've seen before, where an intense major hurricane comes onto the coastline and then backs up right over the same area that it came into originally. So that really ramps up the rainfall amounts. Now, we normally see very heavy rainfall with inland-moving hurricanes, but this one in particular is, it seems, going to surpass what we've seen with any system in the past in terms of how broad that rainfall is and how intense it is. For example, areas around Houston, Texas, have received between about 20 and 30 inches of rain just in the last day and a half, and have another 15 to 25 on the way.
Some parts of Houston and its suburbs could get as much as 1.3 meters of rain before the storm moves out later in the week. Also in the news, North Korea has fired several rockets into the sea as it continues its nuclear and missile expansion. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told Fox News the U.S. will continue to persuade Pyongyang to come to the negotiating table by keeping up what Tillerson called a peaceful pressure campaign. RAND Corporation Korea expert Bruce Bennett's explanation of peaceful pressure.
Peaceful pressure has thus far been primarily focused on economic sanctions. These have been intended to because North Korea mainly builds its own missiles and nuclear weapons, it doesn't have much leverage on those programs directly, but it does impose pain on North Korea as a society under the hopes that Kim Jong-un will decide that it will be better for him to give up the provocative actions he's taking. Thus far, he's chosen that not to be the case. Now the U.S. administration is trying to determine what further it can do that would still be relatively peaceful to deal with North Korea.
And in the past, President Trump has threatened a military response to North Korea's provocations, while South Korean President Moon Jae-in says that will not happen without his country's approval. Up next, the plight of political prisoners around the world. These so-called prisoners of conscience, as they're described, in part as those who have not advocated violence, are being held for their religious or political beliefs, for their ethnicity, sexual orientation, any of a number of issues. Arbitrary detention of citizens is quite common in high-profile nations such as Iran and North Korea, but it also is common in some former Soviet states, for instance. My colleague Rebecca Ward and the host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight, Kim Lewis, speak with Maren Turner. She's executive director of Freedom Now, asking her why countries such as Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan are such hot spots for arbitrary detention.
I would say of all of our work, and we do work globally, so we take cases in countries all over the world. So in essence, we work where there is arbitrary detention, which, as you just pointed out, is certainly a global issue. But in terms of regional, when you really break it down regionally, the former Soviet Union countries is truly a hotspot for arbitrary detention. And the reason for that is during Soviet the Soviet Union times, arbitrary detention was just their chief tactic of cracking down on dissent, whether it was taking people out to Siberia or putting people in mental institutions, which is a practice that's been resurrected in recent years in Russia, which is a very worrying trend, and we're seeing it in other countries in the region as well. And many of the governments in Central Asia and in the Caucasus are remnants of the old Soviet system. So this is a tactic that is just business as usual, and they continue to carry it out. We see waves of crackdowns and then waves of where they'd lighten up on it. And really that just has to do with whatever global issues are happening at the time. And if they are releasing political prisoners, it's usually because they want something from Western countries.
Are most prisoners of conscience mostly jailed or harassed for political reasons? Or are there other reasons that a certain country might go after someone?
There's usually, every country generally has a red line, but I would say in terms of looking at the patterns, the red lines tend to be fairly similar. It's often journalists, it's human rights defenders, it's political activists, and eventually it's often the lawyers as well. So it's anyone who's vocally critical of the government. And whether that's very specifically aimed at officials in the government or it's more generally about the regime, like, for example, in China, where you have dissidents calling for a change of the Chinese government from the authoritarian state to democracy. But what we see most often is the red line that's generally crossed is where, like, to use an illustration in Azerbaijan, it's where they've gone after the president and his wife. His wife, incidentally, is vice president. So it's where the human rights defenders or the journalists make remarks about high-ranking government officials, particularly the presidents, and also speaking about corruption. That's also a very clear red line.
So with that note, I'm going to turn to Kim Lewis, who is particularly interested in the Africa political situation or landscape.
Yes, just looking at journalists in Africa, of course, there are many that have been detained. I know you have done a lot of work in Africa, and I just noticed that on your website, you highlighted a Cameroonian journalist who was released. Just how did you all go about getting him released? And what is his life like now?
I think you're speaking about Louis Mejo,
yes.
Who's actually in back-facing charges. Louis Mejo was an interesting case. We started working on Cameroon in 2009, 2010, and we worked on a couple of cases, and Louis Mejo was one of them. And he was particularly noteworthy because he ran one of the very, very few independent newspapers in the country. So the imprisonment of someone like that goes far beyond just the grave human rights violations of that individual, like Mr. Mejo, and goes to just the rights of the people having access to independent news. So his imprisonment was very far-reaching in its consequences for the population. And he was kept in a prison and held in just deplorable. And this is true in a lot of the countries where we work, but the prisons in Cameroon were particularly bad. So when he was released, it was actually a culmination of a number of different things. We had worked on his case, his legal case, which we'd submitted to the United Nations. But we had also reached out to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at the time, who was traveling to Cameroon to meet with President Biya. And President Biya, who's been president of Cameroon now for more than three decades, is a very elusive figure. And quite honestly, as we understand it, spends very little time in Cameroon. He spends about half his year in Geneva. What his fondness is for Geneva, no one's quite certain about. But what we are certain about is he runs up quite a high tab there. But in that case, we were able to get information to Ban Ki-moon while he was on his way to Cameroon, and he met with President Biya and raised Louis Mejo's case and raised the case of another individual singer who we were working on at the time. And Louis Mejo was released, and he had thousands and thousands of dollars in medical bills because of his poor health at the time. And in 6 months after his release, I got a package in the mail, and it was a copy of his newspaper, which I think brought a tear to everyone's eye in the office because it was truly an illustration of where our work is at its best. Unfortunately, in the last few months, he's been accused of defamation again and is back in custody, currently serving. He was given, I think it was a 3-year sentence with a minimum of 6 months if he pays a fairly ridiculous sum of money and fines.
Maren Turner, Executive Director of Freedom Now. She was speaking with VOA's Rebecca Ward and Kim Lewis. For more of their conversation, you can go to our website, voanews.com, and look for Press Conference USA under the Listen tab. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of Indian astronomers say they have discovered one of the most massive structures that has been found in the universe so far. The astronomers have identified this structure as a previously unknown and incredibly large supercluster of galaxies located some 4 billion light years away near the Pisces constellation. Scientists define a supercluster as a series of galaxies and clusters of galaxies that are bound to each other by gravity. A supercluster can consist of tens of thousands of galaxies. This supercluster was named in honor of Saraswati, the Hindu goddess of knowledge, music, arts, wisdom, and learning. The scientists say their newly discovered giant supercluster extends over 600 million light years across and may have the mass of over 20 million billion suns. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, in our music department report, the King of Soul.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Samuel Dale Cooke, known to most of us as Sam Cooke, was an American singer-songwriter. He was born in 1931 and died in 1964. Many honors have been bestowed on Cooke, known as the King of Soul, and more are just around the corner when dozens of notable performers will gather in Cooke's hometown of Clarksdale, Mississippi, to remember his distinctive voice and the way he changed popular music.
But I'm trying to be, for maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me.
Wonderful World is just one of Sam Cooke's many hits. Many people say his contributions to the world of soul music led to the rise of other greats of the business, such as Aretha Franklin, Bobby Womack, Al Green, Curtis Mayfield, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and Billy Preston. Biographer Bruce Etter once wrote that Cooke was the inventor of soul music and possessed, in his words, an incredible natural singing voice. It was smooth, effortless with delivery, and has never been surpassed. In season 6 of the popular American TV series The West Wing, the President of the United States, played by actor Martin Sheen, honored, posthumously, Cooke with a Presidential Medal for his contributions to music. In that episode, 5-time Grammy winner James Taylor covered Cooke's big hit, A Change Is Gonna Come.
I was born by the river in a little tent, just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know that change is gonna come. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know that a change is gonna come.
Mystery has always surrounded Cooke's death in 1964 when he was shot and killed by Bertha Franklin, the manager of the Hacienda Motel in Los Angeles, California. After an inquest, the courts ruled Cooke's death to be a justifiable homicide. Since that time, the circumstance of his death had been called into question by Cooke's family. Like most R&B artists of his time, Cooke focused on singles. In all, he had 29 top 40 hits on the pop charts and more on the R&B charts. one of his biggest hits from a career that spanned the 1950s and almost half of the 60s, was Twistin' the Night Away.
Let me tell you about a place somewhere up in New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the old and young, twisting the night away. They're twisting, twisting. Everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting. Twisting the night away. Here's a man in evening clothes. How he got here, I don't know.
Hey, are we twisting? Hi, everybody's twisting. I love it. Sam Cooke. Many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more of Sam Cooke.
Twisting, twisting. Everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting. They're twisting the night. Let's twist the line. Twisting the night away. Man, you ought to see her go. Twisting to the rock and roll. Here you find the young and old. Twisting the night away. They're twisting, twisting, man. Everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Yemen is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis of rare proportions. According to the United Nations, around 17 million people go hungry more often than not, and 21 million are in need of humanitarian aid. Around 2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. To make matters worse, Yemen is experiencing an outbreak of cholera, possibly the worst in history. Some 500,000 people have contracted the disease since late April. About 2,000 have already died of it, most of them children under 15 and people over the age of 60. The disease, which is caused by water contaminated with the Vibrio bacterium, is characterized by diarrhea, stomach pains, and severe dehydration. Sadly, this humanitarian catastrophe is man-made. Nearly 3 years ago, war broke out when Houthi militia seized the capital of Sana'a. Within 6 months, and at the request of the government of Yemen, a coalition led by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia began airstrikes on rebel positions to halt their southward expansion. The ongoing conflict has so far killed about 10,000 civilians, displaced millions, damaged public infrastructure, and interrupted the delivery of imports in a country that relies on them to feed its people. Today, much of Yemen's infrastructure, including roads, hospitals, water storage, and delivery and sanitation systems, has been destroyed. Deteriorating sanitation and lack of access to clean water are largely to blame for the cholera epidemic that is presently killing about one person per hour in Yemen. Nearly all of the ill who receive medical treatment survive the disease, but unfortunately, nearly 15 million of Yemen's population of 27.5 million have no access to basic medical care. Since the beginning of the fiscal year 2017, the United States has contributed well over $467 million to help alleviate the humanitarian disaster in Yemen. Although much of this aid is going toward food and nutrition, a substantial amount has been diverted toward fighting cholera. Alleviating the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is a top priority for the U.S. Agency for International Development, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. We call on our partners around the globe and the Community of Nations to join us with generous donations of food, medicines, and funds to help the people of Yemen.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.